It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, welcome back. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's June, and on the Gulf Coast is a big transition. In the upstate, it's a big transition. A little slower, a little less dramatic maybe in the upstate than it is in Mobile. On the Gulf Coast, you know it's this new season coming on, by the way. You won't forget this. You shouldn't forget this. It's the Gulf Coast summer, which is a very distinctive thing. Runs from about June 15th through August 15th. And it's going to be, just look at your forecast. It's going to be raining every day. The daytime temperatures are not going to be that high. They're not going to be super high most of the time because it does rain every day if it's a proper Gulf Coast summer. Some summers on the Gulf Coast, weird things happen, and they get dry, and then temperatures rise a little bit higher. And we don't have rain every day, but very typically we will have rain almost every day somewhere around Mobile Bay. That's Gulf summer, and it's a very different time of year. You're going to see, if those of you who are inexperienced with Gulf summer will discover that your tomatoes are going to have a really hard time. They have a hard time, and it's a hard time not because of the daytime temperatures, but because of the nighttime temperatures. They really can't deal with those high, consistently high nighttime temperatures. Temperatures that don't get much below 75. We could go into that. We won't. I'll let you call. We'll explain. It's time for those flowers and those vegetables that tolerate high temperatures along the Gulf Coast. It's in the upstate we're seeing another transition too. It's to hotter days and drier periods. It actually gets drier now. Every day through the end of August, there's a slightly less chance of rain occurring. It's still wet. I mean, we're an incredibly wet state. I just can't even tell you how wet this state is. You know, I figured out the other day that that if you were to look at a place like any place, let's take Mobile. For example, or Paint Rock in the northeast part of Alabama, those two places, you're getting about almost 2.5 more feet of rain each year than lush places like Asheville, North Carolina, than places like Washington, D.C. Is that not amazing? I mean, almost 100% more rain. It's unbelievable. We get plenty of rain. But rain starts declining in the upper part of the state. High temperatures can really take it out of the soil, so we have to start thinking a little bit more about how to water, and we'll talk a bit more about that as time goes on. It's Father's Day, and I'm thinking, I had a conversation with my dad the other day. He doesn't always remember things, getting older. But I said, Dad, do you remember that Model A? Now, we're not talking about cars. We're talking about tractors. And Dad had a Model A tractor. Now, you know, he had it at a time. I don't know how used it had been. Gone through several hands. It was one of those tractors. It was a beautiful old tractor. You would see them restored now. You wouldn't have recognized the one my dad had based on the restorations, which are all pretty and sparkly. That's not how a tractor used to look. But here's, it had a big flywheel on the side, which is really, really incredible. So you could actually, people actually use that old Model A to turn a sawmill. I remember that they could set it up, or a sawgum mill, or a cane mill, if you want. So you had this big old flywheel, and it had that, it had all of two cylinders. It sounded like one cylinder, but it was chook, 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 chook. You could hear those cylinders popping. It had all of about, what, 25, 30 horsepower, which is about the amount of horsepower you would get out of a decent-sized lawnmower. You know, sit your tush-down lawnmower, the kinds that we seem to insist on now. The little ones that people run around their yards, 25 horsepower, typical of a John Deere mower nowadays for your yard. That was the tractor, and we did most everything with it. And I thought, Dad, it must have been awful slow getting through that back bottom. Oh, because it got big quick, and he was trying to get the trees down so the cows would have something to eat. I said, it must have been, oh, he said, son, that was so slow. You just kept chipping at it, chipping away at it. But it worked. It worked. You know, and so I'm thinking a lot about tools and the tools I grew up with and how they work and whether they work. For most of us, those kind of tractors don't make any sense anymore. A lot of people go out and buy tractors, and then they try to figure out, what in the heck am I going to do with this tractor that does all these things in the landscape, and then they destroy the landscape in the process, because most of the tools we've designed for tractors really aren't designed for thoughtful use of the landscape. They're not designed, you know, mowing all the time, which we can now do with these modern tractors. Worst thing you can ever do for your pasture. You're going to destroy it for wildlife. You're going to destroy it for good grasses, for good summer grasses. It's a problem. We can't even grow the best grasses in our pastures because we're so addicted to the machine itself. So I've been thinking, I could go on about tractors, I could go on about mowing, I could go on about implements, but I want to talk a little bit about the tools that we do use and why we use them, and I'm going to do that a little bit today. You know, when you're working in a garden, as I've said over and over again, don't be addicted to the machine. Don't let the machine tell you what to do. You need to figure out what you need to do in the garden, and then find a tool to do it. Does that not make sense? And over again, somebody says to me, oh man, I got a tiller. And I said, great, don't use it. And they say, but I got a tiller. And I say, great, don't use it. It's the worst thing you can do for your beds. And I can give you five different reasons and six different reasons, and I will, why it's a bad thing for the beds and why it's the reason so many of us have a difficult time gardening. But, you know, I got this tiller. The machine's going to tell us how to live. The machine's going to tell us how to work. The machine's going to tell us how to do our garden. Don't let that happen. Don't let that happen. So we're going to talk a little bit about tools this morning. How to make them work. How to make them work for you. How to find the right tools for your garden. And many times those tools are very simple once you understand what it is you want to do with your vegetables, with your lawn, with your pasture. It's really simple. A lot of great tools out there. Broad forks, some new shovels that I think are really fascinating. They work really great. I'm really pleased with them. New types of shovels. And tools that we sometimes forget about that are so useful and so efficient. Fire. We're going to talk a little bit about all those things. Been using all those tools this past week, trying to figure out which one is the best for each process I'm doing in the garden. We'll be back.
FM Talk 106.5, home for plain living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Alabama Sunday morning. Talking a bit about tools this morning. It's what I'm thinking about. I've got to find some tools to do the jobs I need them to do. And I got some big jobs. And I have several tools. Sort of reminds me of my dad's old Model A. I have an old International tractor that I use occasionally. What is it? 574? If for those who are tractor aficionados, it's a good tractor, good old tractor, does what I need it to do. Doesn't have all of the modern hydraulic fancy stuff on it, but you know, I don't need a lot of that. And most folks don't, even at this large scale I'm working, which is on, you know, 80 acres on some projects. It handles it pretty well. Tools, though, not tractors, because so much of what we do in our garden is based on, it's funny, you know, it's like, I say this all the time, it's like you're still pretending like you're plowing behind a mule, and that's one of your tools, and that you're planting these big, just look, plowing and tilling are not the way you want to work your yard. Let's talk about your soil for just a minute, because it's going to determine the kind of tools that you use. Can we talk about it? It's a good reminder. What do we really want to do when we plant seeds or plants in the garden? Why do we till the soil? Huh? What's the purpose? Well, obviously we got to get the plant in the ground, but that's easy enough. That doesn't really explain that why you would do the tilling part. I mean, you could just use a simple shovel, push that shovel back, put the plant in the ground, and for many plants, that's enough. So, what do we really want to do? What do we really want to do? Well, we want to make a space for the plant to go into the ground. We are a seed. We got to open it up. We got to have some ground contact. We got to have some contact with dirt. You know, one of the big things is we want to get rid of the weeds. And this is a big deal, because there are a couple of kinds of weeds that you want to think about. And one is the weeds that are annuals. And it maybe you can just turn, that is weeds that come from seeds, and you can just turn the living plants into the ground. And that'll kill those living plants. The trouble with that is, annual seeds. Because every time you turn the soil upside or twist it or bring some of the lower soil, even under the lower 2 or 3 inches, to the surface, you know what happens? You get tons of weed seeds that have been buried and that suddenly are exposed to sunlight, and they're going to go crazy. A lot of our weeds need that sunlight to germinate. They don't get the sunlight, they don't germinate. They've been living around folks for a long time. They know what you do. They know you're going to mess with the soil and turn it up. That's why they live with you, because you are so predictable. And so these weeds are going to come up, and they're going to spring up. And so you're going to have worse weeds shortly after you till, just from the annuals. But here's the other problem. What we call perennial weeds. Perennial weeds are the weeds that live more than 1 year. And generally they have root systems that when you tear those roots apart, each little fragment of that root is going to produce a new plant. Oftentimes. Yow! And it's unlikely, even if you rebury the crown of that plant, it's probably got enough energy in that crown to resprout. So tilling, if you think about it, just to give you an example, doesn't work very well to get rid of weeds. So there you go. Plowing doesn't work very well to get rid of weeds either. In fact, it creates new weed problems that are often worse than the ones you started with. Huh? You see what I'm saying? So what are we got a weed problem. And then we got another issue we need to think about with soil when we plant. We want water to be able to penetrate the soil pretty easily. We don't want it to be so hard and crusty, and we don't want a hard pan. And this forms a lot around houses and in fields. And even in sandy soils, you're getting this hard pan where, say 3 inches, is that about the length of your thumb? Somewhere between your first knuckle on your thumb and somewhere between your wrist, if you measure down from your thumb, there's going to be a hard pan in many soils. And the worst hard pans are in sandy soils. This is so hard for people to believe. They say, I got a clay layer in my sandy soil. No, you don't have a clay layer in your sandy or silty soils. What you have is a hard pan. A really distinct layer that has been pressed and compressed to the point that you almost can't dig through it with a tiller. If you run a tiller over it, it just floats over it. And that means water can't penetrate through that hard pan, right? Can't get down. And it means roots can't penetrate through that hard pan. So what happens is it's like a pool that's very shallow on top of your soil. And when it rains all the time, as it's doing now on the Gulf Coast, the water just sits on top of the soil, and it drowns plants because it can't perk into the soil. Plants drown. Yes, they do. They need oxygen. The roots need oxygen. And then, if you got a hard pan up in, say, North Alabama, and it's going to be really dry like it is right now, you know what's going to happen? All that water that's in the soil, that's in that surface soil, because it's not very deep, it's, you know, it may be the water maybe only as deep as your first knuckle or maybe down to the bottom of your thumb. All that water's going to dissipate. It's just going to blow into the air, and there's not going to be any reserves because none of it penetrated down deep, and the roots aren't down deep, so it wouldn't matter anyway, right? So it means that it's going to be more subject to floods and more subject to droughts because of that hard pan. So the other thing you got to do is you got to figure out how to break up that hard pan. And you know, here's the funny thing about tillers and plowing. They create hard pans. They ensure that you will have a hard pan. Trust me. There's plenty of research that shows that. Not an issue. Not an issue to prove that and demonstrate that. So everything about tilling is wrong so far. There's one more thing that tilling does. Let's just look on the positive side. What do we want? We want oxygen. We want water to penetrate deep into the soil. We want oxygen to penetrate deep into the soil because roots need oxygen. And roots need gas exchange. They need to be able, they're breathing in and out. Just like the upper part of the plant is, the roots have to breathe in and out to survive. And so what happens is they need gas to move out of the soil. And that means you need spaces in between the particles in the soil. And if those particles are very fine and flower-like, and there's no space between them, not only does the water not go in, the oxygen doesn't penetrate, and the roots struggle, and the gases in the soil can't escape. There you go. Those are the three major things we're trying to do when we're plowing and tilling, but we don't do it that way because plowing and tilling don't accomplish those things. So we need better tools. We need better tools. We need tools that help us to fight the weeds. We need tools that help us to find a place for the plant to put into the ground. We need tools that allow the roots of the plant to sink deep into the soil. We need tools that allow moisture to follow deep into the soil and form a reservoir down there that keeps it out of just pooling on the top, and that allows a reservoir of moisture down below that the plant can draw on during dry times, and that allows oxygen to move in the soil and gases to move out of the soil. All of these are really important. What kind of tools are we going to use to do that? Well, sorry. Had to explain what kind of tools we're using this morning. We're going to be back. We're going to talk a little bit more about those tools. You give us a call, 251-343-0106. You got questions about what kind of tools you need to start a bed? Give me a call. We'll talk about it, 251-343-0106.
Have you ever seen Pete?
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. You know, weeds have been around for a long time. And it's what they call Adam's curse, I guess. I don't think we're going to change that. There's not an easy way to change that. And even with the modern tools we have to fight weeds, they come back to bite us pretty bad. So, Roundup, or whatever you want to call Roundup now, has some issues. It has some issues. And you can't use Roundup around other plants. There's all sorts of issues. So one of the things to know when you're fighting weeds, and here's a really important tool. A really important tool when you're fighting weeds. And Johnny, I'm gonna come back. Johnny's got a question here about his garden. But one of the really important things to think about when you're trying to fight weeds is that most of the weeds that love to live around us like it when we turn the soil. And they like it when those seeds that get buried in the soil get exposed to sunlight. And it's the sunlight and the temperature that causes them to germinate. Did you hear me? So how are we going to stop the sunlight? Very simple. One of your most important tools in the garden is a mulch. And it doesn't have to be a super sophisticated mulch. It doesn't have to be a high-tech mulch either, because the high-tech mulches don't work for a lot of reasons. So you put down those plastic sheet mulches, and you use them for more than a year, they're going to have a lot of problems. But the first problem is they can't be used on a permanent basis. What you really want is an organic mulch. Just leaves. And on the Gulf Coast, you're really lucky in some ways because you have trees that generally have smaller leaves. In most suburban areas, live oaks, laurel oaks, water oaks, and those leaves don't compact very easily. They actually tend to seem to allow more oxygen to penetrate through them, which is nice. And those leaves are very effective, very effective as mulches. And they will keep seeds from germinating. It's quite impressive. So they keep new seeds from germinating. They don't eliminate the old seeds. They don't eliminate the old seeds unless when you're getting your garden started, you use something I would call a killer mulch. And yes, you can use a killer mulch, and it can be very effective, even against Bermuda grass and Kogon grass. It can be very effective. And a killer mulch means, okay, I'm going to have a vegetable bed. And in that area where I've got a vegetable bed, I just want to take a bunch of leaf bags and dump them there, and I want each of those leaf bags to sit at least knee-high, the pile of leaves to sit knee-high, maybe waist-high, and they're going to smother everything underneath it where I want that vegetable bed. Now, isn't that easy? You have to plan. You got to plan. But it's a really effective way. And then all you got to do is worry about the edges. You do have to worry about the edges because it'll come in from the edges. But that can be very effective way to do. And it'll molder on down, don't you worry. In this climate where everything rots, that mulch will kill those weeds. And then it comes on down. Now, what happens if you've got weeds already and you need to plant right away? Well, it always helps to plan. Don't ignore the planning, because life is so much easier. Let me remind myself, who doesn't plan far enough ahead sometimes. Life is so much easier when you plan ahead, when you start next year's garden this year, when you start this fall's garden now. Life is so much easier. Life is so much easier. And that's the way to do it. But let's say, Johnny, in your beds, I can't tell what grasses you've got. If you've got Kogon grass, you really got to work on it. I think the grass that you have is mostly some type, Johnny, in down in Grand Bay. I think that the grass that I'm seeing where your tomatoes were is one that I would call is a type of crabgrass. It may be goosegrass. It's an annual. It pulls up real easily and makes a great mulch. It makes a great mulch. And it pulls up just super easy. You can pull it up with your hands. You can pull it up with a good fork. It sometimes helps to crack that soil with a fork or with a shovel or with a broad fork. And we're going back to that so that it loosens that soil up just enough that you can pull that out. You don't turn the soil. You never want to turn the soil because you're going to get other seeds germinating. And then you can easily pull those weed seeds out, those annual weeds out. Just pull them out, put them in a pile, just right where you want to make next year's beds. And they'll rot down there. They'll be just fine. They're not going to resprout. It's cool, isn't it? That's a neat way to do it. And it's pretty simple. You could crack that soil and take a rake and pull most of it out, a garden rake. Pulling it out by hand is just about as easy and probably a little more effective. So that can be really effective when you're doing that. And I think that's mostly what you've got there, Johnny, is what I would do. And then when you plant your corn seed, and as soon as it's up, because you're going to need it, particularly with summer coming on and with the high winds, you're going to need it. You want to go ahead and build a mulch up around those corn plants once they emerge. That's like it'll tiller out into that mulch. That's an easy thing to do. So dealing with weeds, that's the tools. Mulch is the key, I think, for most gardeners in dealing with weeds. In dealing with weeds. It's not a tiller. It's not even a herbicide, which won't be as effective and is really difficult to use. It's really difficult to use. But mulch is really effective. Let's talk about that hard pan for just a minute. I know I'm talking too much. But I need you to understand these things. These are sort of the things that underlie everything we talk about in the garden. What are you going to do about that hard pan? And you remember I told you that a lot of soils have an area that water won't penetrate, that roots won't penetrate, and it's somewhere between that first knuckle on your thumb and your wrist. you're measuring from the tip of your thumb down to your wrist. Somewhere in there, there's going to be a hard pan. And it could be, 1 inch thick, 2 inch thick, 3 inches thick, depending on how long you've been pounding that soil with tillers and with foot traffic even will do it, heavy mowers, and rainfall in this high rainfall environment. And you run trucks over it. Oh, man. You build your house there. Oh, it's going to get pounded. So that, what do you do about that hard pan? And I have long advocated for using a fork, a garden fork, a good garden fork that has four tines. And you can just wiggle it. No matter how hard that soil seems, you can just wiggle that into the ground and just lean back. Pop! That's all you got to do. Wiggle it into the ground. Lean back. Pop! You've cracked the soil. You're not turning it. You just cracked it. And that makes a ton of difference. Now, in most gardens, that'll be plenty effective. I will tell you there's another tool that I have seen and that I have used and that I will use again today. It's called a broad fork. And if you're plowing, you probably want a heavier duty one. If you're sort of going at it for the first time, plowing's the wrong word. You're cracking soil for the first time. I use a broad fork. And it's a broader version of that garden fork, and it's a two-handled garden fork. It's got two handles. You wiggle it into the ground. You pull back, and those tines just pop the soil. You can even get them so that they go about 14 inches deep. And that's the one I have, and it can be very effective. All you're doing is cracking that soil, popping it. It's amazing how quickly it works. It's amazing what an area it can cover. It's a great thing for breaking that hard pan up. And now the roots can penetrate, and the water can penetrate, and there's oxygen. And you're not tilling the soil into a fine powder, because once you till that soil into a fine powder, you know what happens? It compresses again, and it gets even tighter than it was before you tilled. So within a few days, that soft, fluffy soil, it's hard as a rock because it's going to recompress because you've torn apart all of the aggregates and things that keep those soil particles from getting too close together. Oh, it'd be fun to talk about all that and how all the processes that work to keep those soil pieces separate. A broad fork works really well, and I recommend it for lawns. I'll tell you, I've seen a new type of, and this is how far behind we are, because we've let machines dictate how we are. So we know that these broad forks work incredibly well. I mean, they're miraculous. But people, compared to almost all the other things we use in the garden, and in the yard, and in the field, but we've let our equipment. Oh, I loved our old John Deere, but my word, we've let John Deere tell us how we have to garden based on the machinery they feel like producing. But that's not the way. The broad fork is the way. So there's some people who have been working on some tools that are really great, like an automated broad fork, believe it or not, that you can use behind a walk-behind tractor. You could easily be designed to use behind my old International 574 with a PTO. And it's just a very simple device. It actually is a broad fork that digs in and pulls the device forward. That you don't even need the engine in. Pulls that device forward. Boom. Boom. And cracks that soil. And really gets through a field pretty quickly or through your front yard. What a great device. I hope that one day it will be available to all of us. Probably going to be a little expensive for you now. Not as expensive, by the way, probably not nearly as expensive as your expensive garden tractor or your expensive lawn mower. But you'll probably balk at the price. It's going to be, I don't know, it looks like around $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 for that tool. But boy, is it useful. I hope some people will buy it and use it. A great tool, and it does everything we need it to do. It cracks that soil without moving it, so we don't stir up the weed seeds. plants can get their roots in. What a great device. What a cool device. Then you can come back with a mulch. Isn't that really cool? So a lot of tools. Depending on what you want to do with your lawn, I'm talking too much. You need to ask me some questions this morning. Feel free. Give us a call. 251-343-0106. 253-251-343-0106. You give us a call. That's okay. Autocorrect does that to you. David, good to hear from you. Yes, David is testifying about how he gave up his tiller. We'll be back, folks.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
All right, folks. Good morning. Alabama Sunday morning, Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Talking about the tools we use in the garden. And I got a little bit more to say. We're gonna hope that you're gonna call to ask me for questions about these things in the next hour. But got a little bit more to say. Kelly called and asked about any thoughts and inputs on caladiums. They do just fine. You know, a lot of people treat caladiums as annuals on the Gulf Coast, and they dig up the bulbs and replant. On the Gulf Coast, most caladiums are going to survive the winter and will come back reasonably well as long as you've got good organic soil. And that's the important thing. You want the best thing for caladiums. They're pretty tough customers, I got to say, because that's why a lot of people grow them. They're pretty tough, and they're bulb-like plants. And as long as the bulbs don't rot, you're going to be fine. In winter, when the soil stays extra wet, I think it's good to keep them, to keep that soil free draining. So you want to crack that soil like we've been talking about, and that's one thing. But you also want plenty of organic matter. That means leaf mulch. Basically, that's the thing. They love it. They love that leaf mulch, and you don't have to dig it in. We'll talk a little bit more about that. You just put it on top. The earthworms are going to work it in our climate pretty well. You can mulch it up if you want it to be faster acting. You can run it through your lawnmower. You can take a bunch of leaves, run them through your lawnmower. Take that bag and just that broken up leaves, put it around your caladiums. They'll love it. They'll be great for them. That'll work a little faster, but you can put the whole leaves on there too, and that's fine too. Even on top, they'll be great. That's great. They're easy. And I don't have any particular varieties of caladium that I think are better than another. I haven't grown them all. Every one that I've grown did just fine. Some didn't survive the winter quite as well as others, and in really cold winters they won't, I suspect. But we don't have many cold winters anymore. not like we used to. Not at all like we used to. Somebody asked, well, a roller with spikes. We were talking about these tools, and a roller with spikes. Let's just look at the golf shoe phenomenon. You remember how people were going to put spikes on their golf shoes and spikes on their shoes and aerate their lawn? That's weird. It doesn't work. But let's say you had spikes that were, let's say they were 3 inches long. That's not deep enough to break that. It's not deep enough to break through that hard pan. And there's another issue, and that is that if you were to just run something straight down, just push something straight down into the soil, all that's doing is compacting the soil around the tine or whatever you pressed into the ground. So what you want is something that you can lean back and crack in a complex way that soil without turning it. That's why a fork works. Imagine how a fork works. That's what you need. You see what I'm saying? Think about running that garden fork into the ground, wiggling it down into the ground, leaning back. And what happens? It's not just where the tines went in. It's suddenly you've lifted the soil just slightly and cracked these little fractures through it that allow water. You see how that works? It's really, that's why we call it cracking. And it really is the kind of work that needs to be done in gardens. And so a cylinder with just the tines, it wouldn't even drive the tines in deep enough. Unless it were extremely heavy. And then by the time it got to be extremely heavy, it just doesn't work. And you really want that, you really want to get down at least, 9 or 10 inches. And preferably, and I can do it with a broad fork quite well, around 14 inches. That's good. That's good. I don't recommend double digging. There's another tool that I recommend. There was the forks and the broad forks. And I want to talk about some of the new shovels because I find they're very interesting. You know, classically, there were a couple of kind of shovels that you could get that had points. Let's say broadly, two kinds of shovels for digging. One was the American shovel with a little point and a broad blade. And it really, you can dig with it, but it was really hard to get into the ground because that blade was very broad. It had a lot of friction, and you could barely get, and it didn't go very deep. And so the other old tool was a spade, and it was a much better, smarter kind of shovel for many products. But I found that it didn't work as well as a fork. Again, for the friction reason. You could sharpen the spade pretty well. But then they've come out with some new types of shovels. And I don't know if you've seen them, but they're fairly narrow, and they have little razor teeth on. And they go by a variety of different names for breaking into soil that hasn't been broken before. I recommend one of those narrow new shovels with a pointed tip and little edged teeth on the sides. Again, they have a lot of different names. It's very effective, and it can be just almost as effective as a fork in many cases. There's something called a root slayer. If you've got plenty of roots, they're a little harder to push into the soil because they don't have a pointed tip. They have a kind of like a bird's tail tip, like a bird's mouth tip that allows you to slice through roots, sharpen it really good. It's a great way of breaking through roots if you need to do that, like tree roots and other things. And those can be pretty effective, too. So some of the new shovels can work really well. We'll talk about that and some of the brands out there. Some of them you have to get on the Internet. Some of them are available at places like Lowe's. Maybe, Rebloom may start carrying some of them. So those tools are pretty good. But, the fork and the broad fork are probably the best for digging. And then I got one other tool, and I would love to talk about it because I just used it on 80 acres. It was pretty impressive. We used this single tool over 80 acres, and we did it in about 2 or 3 hours. You think that's a really fast tractor? That's what we call fire. And fire, if you've got a large acreage, is probably a much better way to manage a lot of landscapes than any other tool you've got. Certainly, it's going to be better than your bush hog. And we ought to talk about that. If you've got any questions about that and why fire would be so much better than, say, mowing, give me a call. Let's talk about it. Finding the right tools. It's the key to gardening, and the tools that we need are not the tools that people were using 50 or 100 years ago, for the most part. Not those big mechanized tools, not the things you're buying at Lowdown Depot, for the most part. Those are designed to spend lots of money so that you can sit down and have something carry you around the landscape. You know what I'm saying? That's not the kind of tools that we need. That's not the kind of tools we need. We need tools for our purpose. Think about what you're trying to do in your garden and use the right tool to do it with. That's the theme of the show today. I've talked too much. I've talked out. I'm not going to talk anymore about this. It's now in your hands to ask me questions about how to use these tools, what kind of tools to use. We'll do that this morning. And if you don't, I'm going to tell you about my fire this week, which was a lot of fun. And very good. And it was about a summer burn, which we don't often talk about. But we're going to talk about how summer burns work and how you have to think about them if you've got a big acreage. And then we're going to talk about my gamma grass planting, why I'm using a broad fork, why it's going to work really well. We'll talk about all those things. And your garden as well. Give us a call. We got another hour coming up. 251-343-0106.
Because everything gonna get down. On your bending knees, I ain't gonna dig no more taters. I decline, I ain't gonna pick no peas.
It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
All right. Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Talking about helping you live with the place where you are. And it's a different place, isn't it? It's a weird place. We got a different set of seasons. And I spent way too much time talking last hour about the tools we need to live with this place. Alex, give me a call back. I missed your phone call. You give us another try. We're gonna talk about it. My good friend, John. And if I may say his last name, John Olive, who is used to be with Auburn, retired now, did great work at the horticultural station there in Mobile. John heeded our call. Amy, listen up. John has got gamma grass. He's going to make it available for the few people who had asked for gamma grass. Amy is one of those. Amy, if you get a chance, call Mobile Botanical Gardens so that you can get some of those plants John is growing out. Pretty exciting. That gamma grass came from seeds around Mobile Botanical Gardens. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? And you know, John, remind me, I want to do the chromosome work on that. We want to figure out whether it's a diploid, tetraploid, hexploid. Sorry for me using words like that on the air. But we got a lot to learn about gamma grass, and it's kind of an interesting thing. So I'll talk to John about that. But Amy, John has done a great favor for you. He's got some gamma grass. Why don't you give the MBG a call, say that I said to call and that John Olive had some gamma grass and you want to know how to get it and when to get it. All right. Let's see what else we got here. So Rusty, we got a couple of things going on. The first one is relatively easy to deal with. Rusty sent me pictures of his field peas, his cow peas. What do you call them, Rusty? What would you like to call them? Maybe they're yard-long beans. I can't tell. But they're in that family, that group. And they're covered in kind of a messy substance that's sticky. That's aphids. Those are cowpea aphids. And they can be a problem. As long as they're not transmitting diseases, your plants survive it pretty well, but they can make things look a little ugly. And they also tend to attract ants because ants love to milk those aphids. So it's a bit of a problem. What are you going to do about it? Well, you can't use a systemic insecticide, obviously, right? because an insecticide that gets in the stem of the plant. You don't want to do that. You could use a soap mixture, just safer soap if you can get a large enough volume, and it works pretty well, but it's kind of messy too. Here's what I would do. Get a hose, a pretty strong hose, and you can usually beat back the aphids pretty well by just blasting your plants with a hose. It's one of the best ways to get rid of aphids, and that's, Rusty, just give that a try. Can you do that? It can work really well. If you can't use the hose, Safer's insecticidal soap works very well to control that. And eventually, usually you'll get an outbreak of the aphids, and as long as the ants aren't tending them too closely, and you can kind of discourage that with the blast of the hose, you're going to get a natural development of predators who prey on those aphids, and you'll reduce your numbers. And that includes things like ladybugs and lace bugs, and there's a whole bunch of them out there that do it. Because they're soft-bodied creatures, those aphids, and they're actually quite tasty to a lot of other insects. And as long as the ants aren't around to tend them, they're really easy to get to. So that's easy. But just spray with a hose. No need to use anything potent. Now, in your Rampicante fruits, what I'm seeing is something that I'm hearing more about this year than usual. Pickle worms. And they are a problem in squash, perhaps more than they are in cucumbers and pickles. I can't tell you, but they seem to love summer squash. They love yellow squash. They tend not to like winter squash as much, and Rampicante is a winter squash, but obviously they're getting after yours, and I'm almost certain that's pickle worms. Could be another worm, but effectively it won't make a lot of difference. It's probably pickle worms. The one thing I can say about pickle worms is they haven't been traditionally a big problem every year. I rarely had problems with pickle worms in my garden, and generally only when I had yellow squash. It was just one of many things that would get after yellow squash. There's not going to be an easy way to deal with those pickle worms because they're inside the fruit. And I don't know, that's a tough one. That is a tough one. I don't think it's going to be a big problem every year. You can control those pickle worms by scouting early while they're still while the plant is in the flowering stage, and you can look for them in the flowers. That's where they are. And spray those flowers with something like BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, and Dipel, Thuricide, works really well. And you can spray the flowers or the tips with BT, and you might go ahead and try that. And that will probably discourage outbreaks in the future because the moths do tend to lay their eggs towards the tips of these plants. I'll think of the name of it here in just a minute. Sorry for that pause. There are a couple of other mild pesticides that'll work. That'll work very effectively if you direct them in the right place. So right now, you want to keep the young'uns, because they cycle through, keep those young ones from getting into the flowers, spraying the flowers and the tips of the plants where your new fruits are going to be forming is the best way to deal with that. And you'll probably want to do it on about an every 7-day basis for the next little while. 7 to 10 days, and you can't do that too many times, or you'll want to alternate. And when my mind gets through with its little, blip, I'm going to tell you what you can alternate BT, the Dipel, or Thuricide with to help control that. That's good to know that we can do that, and that's the best way to deal with those pickle worms. You can't deal with the ones that are already in there, except to cut around them. And it looks like there's plenty of stem that isn't infected, and you can eat that, and that's good. You know, it's also a good reason when you're growing rampicante, don't let it get too big. Pick it when it's small, before the pickle worms have had a real time to get in there and get to work on it. Rusty, does this help? I hope it does. I hope it does. All right, let's see here. What else have we got? I've been looking for a broad fork for some time online, as there are none in stores. Many look weak, and others don't allow me to step on it before it would be shaky. Others have tines that look like they aren't long enough. Can you recommend a brand or model of broad fork? Carol in Huntsville. Carol, yes, indeed. And Carol, you got some good clay soils. So you're going to want a tough one. The Meadow Creature is the best for your area. And so Meadow Creature, it's a great one. It's tough. I've used it. I've used it on some pretty mean, ugly soils, and it stands up. Meadow Creature. I would say, Carol, you can get, they make them in 12-inch, 14-inch, and 16-inch sizes. Under no circumstance do you want to get a 16-inch in those soils. You will never be able to get it in. You'll never be able to press it back. It's just too deep. 14 inches is a good compromise if you've got strength. 12 inches may be what you want to go with. But it's a good one. Meadow Creature. You give me a call if you got any other questions. Love to talk about it.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Cornbread and butter beans, and you across the table. I love that song. That's not what we're listening to now. It's what we listened to on the last outtake. We didn't get to hear all the words, but it's really a great song. We'll play it more. Jim, the Lily Man. Jim, let's don't do it this week, but next week, when people aren't out on Father's Day, you call in. You send me a message. Let's call in. I would love for you to be on the air and talk about it. Jim sends me these pictures of his lilies every week. I mean, Jim has got all kinds of lilies. I mean, they're lilies I've never grown before. I want to know about them. I want to hear about how he grows them. And I want to know what varieties they are. And Jim, you can't tantalize me like this every week. And let's talk about these lilies. Let's talk about your experience with them. So Jim's got some beautiful lilies. Just what a collection. I mean, I think this is Jim's, I'm guessing, given the number of lilies he sends me pictures of. You wouldn't believe this, folks, if you could see my, what do you call this thing? Feed or whatever this thing you call this thing that I get with all these pictures. And there's just this series of pictures of different types of lilies every week. Jim, this is it, son. You got to call me. We got to talk about it next week. Let's do this. Let's have a talk next week. You message me and we'll figure out how to do it. Okay. All right. Yeah, Rusty, I don't know what to say about the pickle worms. They're just annoying. But you can control them, and you can control them, I think, pretty well with BT. And Spinosad, excuse me, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. The Spinosad, if you want a quick, here's what I would do, Rusty, for the pickle worms. Look for the young, see if you've got young, if you've got the eggs or the young worms hatching out around your flowers or on the young fruits, and they haven't dug in yet. Once they dig in, it's too late. But look for the young flowers, look for the tips. That's where those worms get laid, because the moths are smart enough to know that's where the fruits are going to form. Look for those tips. And spray the Spinosad, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D, there. And that'll give you a quick hit. And then follow up in about, let's say, a week's time, week to 10 days, with a BT formulation like Dipel or Thuricide. Both of these are essentially bacterial. I think Spinner says bacterial. Yes, I think they're both bacterial things that naturally attack the insects. And they're not, in a funny sort of way, they're not chemicals. I mean, they are chemicals because all life is chemical, but they're not some artificial chemical. It's they're naturally occurring bacteria that and so yes, it is a all of them are bacteria that attack pests if they're sprayed in the right way, and so that's to do it. And then alternate between those, Rusty, as the year goes on, or until you've got. As long as you're collecting those plants. So pickle worms, there's the key. You know, it's one of those frustrating things. Once it's like squash vine borer. And people say, well, what do I do once I got squash vine borer? Nothing. You can't do anything. Because effectively that borer is inside the stem where it's safe from insecticides. You could, let's say you used a systemic insecticide that could get inside the plant. That means that anything that eats the plant is killed by it. Well, you're eating the plant, folks. So, yeah, you may kill, but you don't want to do that. For so many reasons. Plus, you would kill the bees that are pollinating the flowers, which you need to pollinate. There's so many reasons why squash vine borer is difficult. And that's why I recommend varieties that are resistant to squash vine borer on the Gulf Coast and hard-stemmed squash. You can call me. We've talked about them before. We can talk about them again. They can be really good, but you want varieties that are resistant to squash vine borer. But I read a whole thing about squash the other day, and we can talk about that. If you've got trouble with your squash and you don't know what to do about it, we can talk about it. So you can give me a call. I'm not going to go off on it if you're not listening, and if you don't want to know. Organza bags for tomatoes. This is Clay in Birmingham. One of the best tools I have adopted, and this is smart thinking, is organza bags for tomatoes. Keeps the stink bugs away and really protect them from squirrels last fall. The 4x4 size works best. Lady P is doing real well today. Let's talk about this. Organza bags are those little things. You know, does anybody go to weddings anymore? I think you do. And if you go to weddings, do they still throw rice in? They give you those little bags with the rice in them? I think that's what you call, Clay's calling organza bags. And there may be other names. I don't remember. But they're that pretty, pretty white mesh bag. And a lot of times you get them, and they got a little pretty little sort of fake silk string at the top or band at the top that you can use to tighten them. And they're pouches. These are great for putting around fruits that you don't want to see damaged or eaten. And if you've got peaches, it's a good way to deal with a lot of the peach issues. Because peaches can easily get damaged. It's a great way of dealing with tomatoes. As Clay says, it keeps, if you've got a big tomato, don't try this with small tomatoes. You don't need to. Small tomatoes have their own resistance because they produce so many that you don't even have, I mean, you don't really notice the ones that are missing to the stink bugs. And even the squirrels. Don't get to them. But if you got big tomatoes, take those organza bags and just put them around the tomatoes as they're beginning to develop. And if you've got a problem with squirrels, quit feeding the birds. That's the first rule. Honestly, don't think feeding the birds helps the birds. But it certainly helps the squirrels. And it will build up squirrel populations locally pretty significantly. And that's the first, but let's say you can't or you don't or you won't, then one thing you can do to protect your tomatoes is use those organza bags. What a great thing, Clay. Thank you for mentioning that. His lady peas are doing really well. Rusty, hadn't had any aphid problems. Clay, if you have any aphid problems, I often have aphid problems on my peas, and it will be like on just one or two plants. Sometimes it can spread to a lot of plants, and if it's just on one or two plants, I try to ignore it for a while. If it spreads to more than just a few plants, then I'll come in and spray, just because the ants keep building up populations. You know, there's this weird relationship between ants, including fire ants, and aphids. And the ants, and particularly fire ants in most of our yards, because that's mostly what we got, will literally milk those aphids for the honeydew. And in exchange, the aphids get protected from the normal predators that would normally control the aphids. It's kind of weird how all that works. And we've had that problem on, Clay, was it you had the problem on okra? I think so. I mean, we've all had that problem in various ways. It's just aphids on, and I generally, a stream of water works pretty well. Sometimes when it gets pretty bad, I think maybe it was Clay, said, look, I've tried this and it still isn't getting to them. In that case, maybe you could try something like insecticidal soap, which works pretty well to control that. And I think on okra and peas, it'll work just fine. It's just you got to figure out how to get enough of it, and you're going to have to get a sprayer, because these are big plants, and you don't want to just use a little squirt bottle like you get at Lowdown Depot. You're going to need a big bottle of that insecticidal soap, and it works really well on aphids. It just really works well. So you can spray that on there, and, you know, it's pretty safe. It doesn't have a lot of phytotoxicity. That is, it doesn't affect the plant in sunlight. It doesn't cause any problems, which can be a problem with some types of treatments. Don't make your own soap. Buy Safer's insecticidal soap, because it's safer than what you could mix up at home, which sometimes can have weird things in it that you don't want to use. So get some Safer's insecticidal soap. That's another way to deal with those things at a large scale. All right, let's see what else we got. Good, Carol, I hope that's good enough. Meadow Creature is the name of that fork, and it's worth it. It is worth it, Carol. It works really well. I've got one. It'll last forever. When you get through with yours, you can give it to me. but mine's great. It's worth great. I've bought some other brands. They don't last as long in heavy soils. All right, look at this. We're running through our time quickly. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
All right. So Bruce is telling me that for difficult aphid infestations, you can, on peas, he used spinosad spray plus spinosad granules for the ants. You have to take care of both, and I agree. Listen, one thing about products like spinosad and BT, they're pretty safe for humans. They're actually pretty safe, reasonably safe for the environment, because they are more or less naturally occurring bacteria. And so it's not like we're inventing some new thing that's going to have an effect that we can't predict. But the trouble with any insecticide, and this is my first, please believe me, I was exposed to this very early on, is non-target problems. You don't want, if you're not careful with broad spectrum insecticides, and spinosad is one, you have a, well, it's a little more broad spectrum than some, you might wipe out your predators as well, and then you can have other predators, being a good thing in this case, because they're preying on the pests in your garden. You might have a bigger pest problem than you had before. So you want to be thoughtful about that. That's why I say try the simplest remedies first. And sometimes the simplest remedies are very effective. Water is great on most aphid populations. They're great. And secondly, you can use insecticidal soap. That's also great. And then if you need it, come back with the spinosad. But you definitely want to alternate treatments. You never want to use just one product, or you develop resistance to that product. And spinosad won't be different because it's not mutating. And even though it's a natural thing, we aren't really developing as something that can keep up with the changes in the pest populations. So the pest population will become more and more immune to this, but because we're bottling this stuff and we wanted it to be really predictable, etc., it's not really evolving to keep up with the pest. There's just no other word for it that I know of right now. That's just the way you would say it. It can't, as the Red Queen would say, you got to keep running to stay in one place. That's what she said in Alice. And it's sort of the way we understand evolutionary biology now, is that citrus trees aren't running anymore. They have been running since about 1700 AD, a lot of citrus. And, say satsumas. And what a wonderful thing satsumas are. But they're not running. They're just staying the way they are. They're not changing. We're creating identical satsumas over and over again with very little variation. But all of the pests and diseases that affect satsumas, they're changing quickly and rapidly. You got to keep running to stay in one place, said Alice, or said the Queen to Alice. And that's what you got to do. So make it harder on the pest by alternating. If you're using a technique that works, alternate it. Now, water is going to work regardless. It just does. I mean, insects don't develop a resistance to a hard spray of water. I suppose over time, but it's not likely. But that's what's cool. You can use it every year. As long as it works, it works. Insecticidal soap is also good because they don't really develop resistance to something like insecticidal soap, which eats away at their skin. Works really well. It's not some refined thing that works on their interior nerve system, which they can develop resistance to fairly quickly. Soft-bodied aphids are always going to be susceptible to soap. I feel safe in saying that. All right, there we go. What else we got here? Love the organza bags. Tools. Alex isn't going to call me back. That's too bad, Alex. I'm sorry. Just give me a call next week if you can't make it this week. I'd love to hear from you. And I'm not getting calls from the rest of you. So I'm going to talk about one of my favorite tools this week. And it's a tool we've forgotten about, which is burning. It's very hard to do this in a suburban area, and I urge extreme caution, if not completely abstaining from burning in a suburban area. It's not appropriate. But some of you who call in have an opportunity to use fire, and we talk about fire a good bit here. It had a lot of really interesting impacts. And if you're trying to maintain a pasture, or if you're trying to maintain wildlife, you might say, well, okay, what am I trying to accomplish here? Well, depends on which wild creatures you're going after. But let's understand that grasses and grasslands were as important to Alabama as forests were. And if I said to you, oh, I'm going to set aside this forest, I'm never going to let anybody cut those trees, you'd say, oh, Yeah, I understand that. He's just a, you know, we tolerate that more. But if I said to you, I have a grassland, and I'm gonna keep it a grassland forever, and that's important. People don't recognize how important that grassland is. And in fact, the rare creatures in Alabama are almost inevitably associated not with forests, but with grasslands, which were so much a part of Alabama. That's why you don't hear quail anymore, because we lost our grasslands. And turkey, you don't want to talk about turkey? It's great. You want to talk about forage for deer? They're not eating the grasses, but they're eating everything else that grows up with the grasses. So you got to think about a lot of different things. But the way to begin to get that back, the tool that we use a lot is fire. And there's a lot of questions that have to be asked about fire and whether it's appropriate and how it's appropriate. But boy, what an incredible tool. Why does fire work better than mowing? Sometimes mowing can be used to protect a pasture. But if you mow more than once a year, if you mow your pasture more than once a year, chances are you're going to destroy any value it has to wildlife. That's the story. So something to think about. Fire, on the other hand, is an incredible tool. And it's an incredible tool because it allows things to germinate. And we'll come back and talk about why here in just a minute. Shane, what's up? What you
what's
got?
What's happening, brother?
Well, I'm just... Yeah, yeah.
I got a question. You know, we just bought a house, and there's weeds in the grass. I mean, I'm just curious. You know, I put in my old house, you know, I used to put out Scott's Turf Builder, blah, blah, blah. But there's all kinds of different types of, you know, weeds that are in it. Can you explain what I should do from start for the, like, for a full year starting today? What should I do to make that, you know, fertilize and get rid of those and...
Yeah. So let's keep it really simple. And this is really important. One, fertilizer's not going to make a big difference in terms of whether you have weeds or not. Fertilizer's not going to help at all. What makes a huge difference in terms of weeds is how tall your grass is. Boom. That's it. If you mow your grass tight, if you mow it down to, say, 2 inches, you're going to have a ton of weeds. There's just no way around it. If you have St. Augustine, or if you have some of the new Zoysia types, and you mow them to about 4 inches, or even 4.5 inches, or 5 inches, which is great, all works just fine. Nobody will ever know the difference in the height, except that the higher it is, up to about 4 to 5 inches, the lusher it's going to look. If you mow it high, you're going to eliminate most of the weed issues. Most of the weed issues will be gone. And that's the key.
That.
Yes. Do you know what kind of grass you have?
It looks like a St. Augustine, and it looks like there may be some bluegrass in the back or something. Kind of looks like something on a golf course.
Probably not bluegrass, but... that would only be a spring thing. So don't worry too much about the spring weeds. If you're worried about the spring weeds, you just mow in winter. And you could mow low in winter if you wanted to. I don't really care about those spring weeds. They actually don't do any damage to the lawn because the lawn hasn't really matured yet. They're just fine. And you get some flowers and you get some bees and it's all fine. The summer weeds are the ones that can be devastating, but usually only if you mow too tightly. Now, you'll also get weeds in areas where you've lost the sod to diseases. So you have to kind of watch that, and we can talk about that. But let's don't talk about problems that you don't have yet. The simple solution is, if you've got St. Augustine in particular, raise your mower height. And now it is particularly important to raise your mower height. You really won't have to mow any more than you're mowing now. It won't look like it's any taller, except that it's lusher, but it will shade out that ground and it will keep weed seeds from germinating.
Huh, that's a great tip.
Yeah, it's just isn't that simple? It's incredibly simple. I never fertilized my yard. I never used weed and seed. And I always had pretty good St. Augustine. Occasionally you'll get a weed in there. And when you see a weed, after you've mowed it high, you call me, let's talk about them. There are a few weeds that require some special techniques just to keep them from getting to be a problem. And we're seeing them more and more as a problem because of the way we mow and because of the way we transfer sod and other things. Poor Joe is one of those, Diodia. But let's don't talk about the problems that you don't have yet. Let's just talk about the simple things that you can do. And don't even – you can't use a herbicide until you know what kind of grass you have and you're absolutely sure. And you can't use a herbicide until you know what kind of weeds you have. And even then, in most cases, herbicides aren't very effective against the weeds that are most common. So, Mohai, that's it.
Well, that'll work, man. That's just unbelievable. Great tip. That's all I can
say.
I'll do it. Yeah, if something happens, I'll definitely call you back.
Makes a ton of difference. You don't have an irrigation system, do you, Shane?
I do not.
Good. Then I don't have to worry about telling you anything else right now. You just Mohai.
All right, will do. Thank you so much.
All right, great. Jarhead, man, we're coming into the break, and I don't want to miss this conversation with you, but I'm just saying, can we just sort of fiddle around here and let's get through this break, and can I come back and talk to you?
Sure. Well, that's what I told Philip. I know we were coming up on a break, so I would. But while you're waiting on a break, I will say that. Your little trick with the fork works great on bare spots in your lawn.
Oh, it is great. That's a great point. I should have said that earlier. We'll come back. I just was telling somebody the other day. All right, Jarhead. Great. Thanks for holding on. We'll be right back.
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Alabama Sunday morning. Jarhead, thank you for holding on. And Jarhead wanted me to remind everybody that you can use a broad fork or a garden fork. If you've got patches in your yard that are bare spots, here's what's happening. That has reached a point at which, in this climate, with this amount of rainfall, it's reached a point where you've got a hard pan there, and nothing will grow there for a variety of reasons. So if you can crack that soil, we're not tilling it, folks. We're just cracking it. And Jarhead, am I... Tell us what you did, Jarhead.
Well, Bill, I just got the fork, and mainly it's like places where vehicles might have been parked for a long period of time, or your trailer, or a walking path that you don't have stepping stones or something. You just go in there and you stick it in and wiggle around a little bit, and as soon as it rains, the grass starts coming back vigorously, I would say.
Yeah, it's amazing. And if you've got things like St. Augustine, it's going to move into it. If you've got zoysia, it's a little slower, and you got to think about zoysia a little more because it doesn't spread as quickly as things like St. Augustine. Centipede doesn't move as quickly, but it's going to – the problem is that Jarhead hit it. I mean, it's just that it's compacted. It's been pushed down, and sandy soils get pushed down and compressed really easy. Silty soils do too, and particularly when they stay wet, because when they get wet, it's just really, you ever notice that when you go out in your yard and it's just like, it's like you're floating on some of those sandy soils around Mobile. You kind of float because it's just so much water, and what it does is it just allows that soil to get really compacted even when people just step on it. So you got a path the dog's been using, wears out the grass, then it starts pushing in the soil, and then you got a problem. Crack it. That fixes it. Jarhead, that was our advice to the rest of the public.
What I wanted to talk to you about was what we call deer vine. And
okay,
it's got green elongated waxy leaves. They're up maybe an inch and a half wide. I have seen this thing get an inch or bigger at the base, and it does have thorns, and I swear if you watch it, you can see it grow. And it only grows in shady spots, say around the base of my live oaks or under azaleas or some of the other ornamental trees that I have in the yard. And I have tried your little trick with the Roundup, and it used to work. And now it seems like with this new Roundup formula, all it's doing is burning it back to a certain point. And these things have, like, the roots on them are, look like a big giant mutant potato. And for a vine that is 15 foot tall, this thing can be as big as a watermelon.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, is there anything else other than digging these things up or just cutting them back continuously that you can recommend?
Yeah. So this is what he's talking about is Smilax, which is we used to call sawbriar, greenbriar. And the old expression jarhead is like a mule eating sawbriars, smiling like a mule eating sawbriars.
Okay.
Is what we used to say. So deer love it. Deer love to eat it. And it's actually quite good for humans to eat as well, which we'll talk about on another day. It comes in places where you don't mow, right? That's why you see it in the shady places where you're not mowing as much. And so it's coming in those places. It doesn't actually like shade. It likes full sun. It's just that you're mowing those areas in full sun, and so it's not coming in there. Here's the problem. Let me get to this real quickly. Jarhead, you can find the right formula that will work. And Jarhead's talking about something that I recommended, which is to get a jar of glyphosate, which used to be called Roundup. We're not going to call it that anymore because they've made a mess of Roundup. But you get a jar of glyphosate, G-L-Y-P-H-O-S-A-T-E. You mix it so that you just put a little bit in the bottom of a milk jug. It's classic. Get a gallon milk jug. Put about a thumb's depth of that herbicide in there, and then pour water in about halfway, not even halfway in the milk jug, then run the vine down in there and just let it absorb it. And it will make a big difference. It takes a long time for that waxy leaf to absorb it. The other thing to remember, Jarhead, is that it's better to do it in spring when the foliage hasn't gotten waxy yet. So when that new growth comes on, or when you see new growth, it's better to put the new growth in there because it's going to absorb it much better. Let me talk about why the Roundup they're selling at Lowdown Depot may not work anymore. Because it's got something in there that is a quick killing formula, which is designed to fool you into thinking it's working. But if it kills it quickly, it's not getting into the root system, and so it has no effect. So use a glyphosate formula that just has glyphosate, and maybe a carrier, but nothing else. So don't use the Roundup formulas that they're selling now that are super quick or quick acting. You got to use the old slow, old-fashioned 47% glyphosate. And if you go to Tractor Supply or some of the other places, they sell it as glyphosate. And you can use that and mix it in a milk jug, and it should work pretty well. These vines take longer than a lot of vines because they do have that waxy cuticle and because they do have that big storage tuber. But even given all that, it should work pretty well if you find the right glyphosate.
I have some stuff that I talked to you about before, and it's made by Alligator, and it's called Mojave 70EG. And it looks like the active ingredient is something forgive me if I pronounced these wrong, imazapyr and duron.
I don't know that that'll work. I don't know. You can try it. Imazapyr, I know. Imazapyr can be soil active, so you want to be careful about that around using it around other plants. The advantage of using the glyphosate by itself is that it is not soil active. It won't affect the azaleas and other things that this vine is growing out of. So I can't recommend Mojave because I haven't used it. My instinct is that it would not be appropriate for this kind of use.
Well, I have been told that this stuff, and it says it's a bare ground vegetation control, and I have been told that if you spray it around a full-grown live oak, water oak, whatever, that eventually it will kill the tree. This is how potent this stuff is.
That's right. And that's exactly why imazapyr is a problem.
Be great for fence line.
Yeah, I it would be. They're water soluble. They move into the soil, even from the plant itself. You would want to be really careful in any kind of landscape about using imazapyr, because it does move through the soil very easily. So that's why I don't recommend Mojave, but I would recommend, it's going to be really hard to, I'll have to double check on this. I think that even if you technically could get it just on the plant, there's a good chance that enough of it could get into the soil from the roots of the plant to affect the azalea that it's planted underneath. For example, that the Smilax is planted underneath. So
I'll just have to go to Tractor Supply and see if I can find some glyphosate and see if I can do this, because I know we're getting short. But let me just say real quick. I had never been a big plant person until the unfortunate death of my neighbor, who gave me the amaryllis. And she also gave me some things that people want to look at. And they're calla lilies and gladiolas. They make beautiful blooms, and they're pretty all through spring.
Yeah, this is great. And, Jarhead, it's always good to hear from you. Thank goodness for your neighbor who got you interested in all this. Call me back next week if you have any more questions about that. All right, come back with any questions.
Have a great day.